Hello, this is Rabbi Jeffrey Sachs with another shiur in our series on the history of Torah Shebaal Peh from webyeshiva.org. Okay, good evening. We are continuing with our analysis of the Rambam's Hakdamah LePerush HaMishnah. Last session, we talked about the Rambam's glowing admiration for Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi and the establishment of the Mishnah as the great crowning achievement of the Torah Shebaal Peh. The codification of the oral law from the moment that Moshe Rabbeinu ascends the mountain until around the year 200 CE with the composition of the Mishnah by Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, and we talked about the significance and impact of that on Rabbinic Judaism, on the oral law, on the Torah Shebaal Peh, and really even on the Rambam himself, the Rambam who lives almost 1,000 years later, certainly working almost 1,000 years later, and composes his own codification of the oral law, or recodification, and the impact of one on the other. Let's just go a little bit forward here. Here we go. We're in the third section, or the third chapter, of the introduction, of the Rambam's introduction to the Mishnah. And the Rambam is talking about this issue of the different components of the Torah Shebaal Peh. Here, for example, I hope that you can all see this. Here you go. The Rambam had made this point about Kol HaTorah Ne'emra Klaloteha Ufrateha V'Dikdukeha Misinai. The Torah was given. I'll translate quite literally now, but it could be that by the time we're done, we'll have to reevaluate what the Rambam means by this. But that the Torah was given in all of its detail, klaloteha, its general principles, ufrateha v'diktukeha, its more specific and minute details were all given at Sinai to Moshe when Moshe receives the Torah. Mahin oto alachot yechidot asher yo'amru bahem shehen halacha lemoshe misinai. So the Rambam has a question. We have this notion of a halacha lemoshe misinai, that there were certain halachot that were given to Moshe Rabbeinu when he received the Torah, even though they weren't written down black on white in the Torah. But the Rambam is curious. If we say Kol HaTorah Nemra Klaloteha Ufrateha V'Diktukeha Misinai, if the entirety of the Torah, from the great principles of Anochi Hashem Elokecha down to the Kotso Shel Yud, the tiny minuscule details were given at Sinai, what does it mean to classify a halacha as a halacha l'Moshe Misinai? Isn't everything a halacha l'Moshe Misinai? Isn't everything given over to Moshe Rabbeinu? This is an important point that we should discuss, as the Rambam. Vuhu shehapirushim hamikubalim mimoshe ein machloket bahem b'shum panim. The explanations, the received explanations, the received traditions from Moshe, there is no machloket. There is no difference of opinion. You'll remember that we left off last time with this question. How could there be machloket? In other words, if the system has integrity, and and the entirety of the Torah was given to Moshe Rabbeinu, and we are the heirs of that Torah, how could there be machloket about anything? Where does that come from? So the Rambam is clarifying that there's not machloket about everything. There's certain things about which there is no difference of opinion. What are those things? So those are the received interpretations, the received explanations of the Torah that were given to us from Moshe. About that, there is no debate. Lefi shme olam lo matzanu machloket shenafla bein hachamim bizman min hazmanim mimoshe v'ad Rav Ashi. So from the time of Moshe until the completion of the Talmud, the Talmud is completed, the Gemara, the commentary on the Mishnah, the expansive commentary on the Mishnah, is completed around 300 years after the codification of the Mishnah. The Mishnah is codified around the year 200, the Gemara around the year 500. So the Rambam says throughout that entire period, there was no machloket about the received traditions from Moshe. What are these received traditions from Moshe? We'll have to explain in a minute. Shamar, we never saw an example, the Rambam says, of somebody that disagreed about this category. And then he begins to give examples of this category. Sorry, just responding to a chat. Ezra, are you online? Ezra, are you there? So I just got a chat from Joel Nowicki that he's having trouble logging on, and I see that Alan Goldenberg doesn't... Okay, Seder. Okay, fine, you're on top of it. Okay. So the examples of halachot about which there's no machloket is the interpretation of a pasuk like ayin ba'ayin, right? That we never said she'achad mehem shemisha simei ayin adam tisame eino, right? The Torah says, we just read it, ayin tachad ayin. The literal reading of that pasuk would be, if you poke out my eye, I get to poke out your eye. That would be the literal reading of that pasuk. But we never interpreted that pasuk the way it literally reads. There never was a machloket about this matter, and we always understood that in cases of bodily damage, if Reuven causes bodily damage to Shimon, he blinds him, he pokes out a tooth, what have you, that it means that there's a financial restitution that he has to pay. He has to compensate the damagee for his loss. So the Rambam says this is something about which there was never a machloket, even though it's not written that way in the Torah. So, you know, we have all types of cases where there's a tradition of a text and a way that the text is read. So even, for example, this is an example that we came up with, I think, last semester. This word that I put on the... Again, I just mentioned this by way of metaphor. This word that I put up on the board. How do you read that word? We're all native English speakers here. How do you read that word? Esther. Colonel. So how would you... I mean, if you had to... write that phonetically, how would you write it? Probably something like that. Yeah, or K-E-R-N-O-L, right? And if you look in the dictionary, you know, where they give the phonetic spelling. But where's the R? Right? It's a very, very strange word. Now, there are reasons, there are etymological reasons why this word, which I think, you know, comes to English through French or something like that. If you're interested in that, you know, Google the word. I'm sure you'll find a very quick answer. But it's more than just a kri and a chtiv. In English, we know this. Just like in the Torah, we have this tradition of kri u chtiv. There are certain words that are written one way in the Torah, but when we read them in shul, we read them differently than what they're written. So it's not just that, you know, when you read, you know, in many ways, of course, Hebrew is a much, much, much easier language to learn than English, because Hebrew is a phonetic language, and what you see is what you get, right? You know, the word, if you can decipher the characters and the vowels, you know exactly how to pronounce the word. You may not know what the word means, but you know that you can properly pronounce the word, because there's only one way to pronounce the each vowel, and there's only one way to pronounce the consonants. But in English, it's completely unlike that. Try, in other words, if you're not a native English speaker, you know, try making sense of how that word, the word that we pronounce thought, it's a silent G. What's a silent G, right? I'm sure we can all think of dozens of examples. So I think we talked about this last semester when we talked about kri uchtiv, about the written and the spoken tradition. Oh, no. We spoke about it when we were learning Masechet Sanhedrin, which was probably two semesters ago. Some of you were with us for that, about kri uchtiv. But here, it's not exactly parallel, but the idea that there's a pasuk that says ayin ba'ayin or ayin tachat ayin, an eye for an eye, but it doesn't matter what's written. Ayin tachat ayin means financial retribution. But for whatever reason the Torah chose, it's not written that way. It's written in a shorthand. And we all know that language means certain things, and sometimes it's meant literally, and sometimes it's meant figuratively, and sometimes, depending upon the inflection, it means the exact opposite of what it is. So that, for example, you know, and you have to know that there's a tradition of how these things work. What's the meaning of this word? Anyone? Well, anyone? The red word at the top of the board here. Don't you see what I wrote up on the board? Oh. Yeah. So what's the meaning of that word? Yes. Yes, the affirmative. So there's a general notion that in languages, and it's not just true in English, it's true also in Hebrew, that if we double something, it emphasizes it. So that, you know, if somebody asks you a question and you say no, you could also say no, 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 no. And that makes it more emphatic. If you're writing dialogue, that makes it more emphatic. But if you were to say, so yeah means yes, it means to affirm something. But what does that mean? It means the exact opposite, depending upon the inflection. If somebody says something and you respond, yeah, it means you're affirming it. If somebody says something and you respond, yeah, yeah, what does that mean? The exact opposite. And these are all, again, I'm not, don't let me overstate these metaphors, because they're like all metaphors, they're imperfect, but it shows that in any written text, in language, there has to be an interpretive tradition of what it means. And for an outsider, it would seem completely unintelligible. It would really seem completely unintelligible. So ayin tachat ayin, if you land from Mars and you don't know anything at all about Judaism or about the Torah or about the Bible, and you check into a motel and you take the Bible out of this is the example I've given in the past, this Martian, right? How he's going to read the written Torah without any context. So ayin tachat ayin literally probably means you poke out my eye, I get to poke out your eye. You hit me, I get to hit you. You poke out my tooth, you knock out my tooth, I'm entitled to knock out your tooth. But the tradition is that that's not how the pasuk is read. That phrase means something else. Va'amar acher shehadamim bilvad hu chayav. That it's merely a matter of financial restitution. And about this matter, there never was, says the Rambam, there never was machloket. There never was another tradition. There never was another tradition of how to interpret this pasuk. And that's the pshat of the pasuk. You know that we talk about the different levels of biblical interpretation. Generally, we talk about pardes, pshat, remez, drash, sod. Four different modes or levels of biblical interpretation. And generally we say that pshat means the literal reading. Here, hold on a second. Why is this not working for me? Oh, I'm not sure if the Hebrew is displaying properly. I apologize. I recently got a new computer, and you'd think a new computer is better, but sometimes the newer computers cause some problems with the interface, which we're trying to work out between Windows 7 and the software. But I hope that displays properly. Pshat. Pshat generally means the simple interpretation. It does not mean the literal pshat, like in Hebrew, we also have the word pashut. Pashut meaning simple. So pshat doesn't mean the literal interpretation. It means the simple interpretation or the accepted interpretation. So the pshat of ayin tachat ayin, it's a mistake to say that the pshat of ayin tachat ayin means you poke out my eye, I poke out your eye, but that the drash is you don't literally poke out the person's eye, you pay the money. The pshat of ayin tachat ayin, the simple reading of ayin tachat ayin, is financial retribution. Right? Even though the words literally would read, according to the Martian landing in the motel, would mean my eye for your eye. V'lo matzanu gam machloket b'mamar Hashem pri etz hadar, says the Rambam. In Parshat Emor, by Sukkot, here, Pri Etz Hadar is what we call an etrog. Hold on a second. There was another document that I wanted to load up. Give me 1 second to load up the document. There you go. Right, the Torah says that on Sukkot, ulakachtem lochem biyom harishon, pri etz hadar, kapot marim anaf etz avot, arvei nachal, usmachtem lefnei Hashem Elokeichem shivat yamim. I know that a number of you are learning Masechet Sukkah with us now. Sherry asks, how do we know where the pshat is literal and where not? That's what the Torah Shebaal Peh is. The Torah Shebaal Peh is the tradition of how to read the Torah, right? And those traditions are how you interpret the Torah. That was largely what Rashi's agenda was. Rashi's agenda in interpreting Chumash was to fill in the Pshat reading, right? To tell you that when you see the words, yeah, yeah, it doesn't mean double yes. it means double no. It's to give you the code, as it were. By code, I don't mean any in any way those Torah codes. You know, you know what I mean by the Torah codes, where if you read every 63rd letter and you put it together and read it backwards and hold it up in a mirror, it gives you like the results of the 1942 World Series. I mean the code of how to read the Torah, what the proper interpretation of the Torah is, and when it's literal, and when it's literal figurative. That's the agenda of the Torah Sheba'al Peh. And Rashi, in trying to anthologize the entirety of the Torah Sheba'al Peh into a running commentary on the Chumash, is helping us out with that. But without Rashi, we could just learn all of the Midrash and all of the Gemara and etc. And we'd know it that way. Or our teachers would tell us. That's what Torah Sheba'al Peh is. Right? The Torah Sheba'al Peh, learning Gemara at its heart, or even learning Mishnah at its heart, is the attempt to explain what the Torah is getting at, and what the psukim mean normatively. So lokachtem lachem biyom arishon pre Eitz Hadar. So again, literally pre Eitz Hadar means the fruit of a hadar tree. What hadar means, we would have to understand. But let's take it to mean pretty or goodly. So you have to take for yourself on the first day the fruit of a good tree, of a pretty tree. Let's leave the other three minim out of that. So what's the fruit of a good tree, of a pretty tree? Perhaps it means, you know, anything that looks nice, that there are certain fruits that are very pretty and there are certain fruits that are very ugly, and you can take anything. No, but the Rambam says that this is the esrog, right? In English it's called the citron, and that about this matter, the identification of these four species for Sukkot, about this there is no machloket. Right? Right, about this, there was never machloket. There was never an alternate tradition. There was never, even though the Gemara in Masechet Sukkah entertains hava aminot, it hypothesizes why is it an etrog and not something else. But those are merely hypotheses, meaning ideas that are raised for the purpose of rejecting them, in order to bolster the tradition that it really is, in fact, an etrog. And there was never a case that somebody said it was an etrog, and somebody said it was a parish. A parish is a different type of fruit. It's probably what's called today a quince, which looks something like an ugly apple, but you can Google it and find a picture of it. O rimon, o zuladze. Velo matzanu gam kein machloket be eitz avot. There was never a machloket about what the Eitz Avot is, right? Shehu hahadas, the myrtle, right? These are the hadasim here on the left. About the hadasim, there was never a machloket, even though the Torah does not tell you hadasim. It uses some kind of nickname, right? That it's called the Eitz Avot. From the fact that the Torah calls it an Eitz Avot, Chazal learn out something about what's the nature of the Hadasim, or what's the appearance of the Hadasim. But about this, the Rambam says, these were all the received traditions from Moshe. Mikubalim mi Moshe. Again, Mikubal, or Kabbalah, here has nothing at all to do with mysticism, with the colloquial understanding of the term Kabbalah. It has to do with the reception of the, that anachnu mikablim, we receive these traditions and we hopefully pass them on. And then the Rambam gives another of other examples of where the literal reading of the Torah is at best unclear, or at worst, right? Pre-Eitz Hadar is unclear. We don't know what that means without a tradition that tells us what it means, without a tradition that points to a specific fruit on the store shelf. Other cases, it's not merely that we don't know what it means, but it would lead us in the wrong direction. Ayin tachat ayin, an eye for an eye, if implemented literally, would lead us to a mistake. It's not just that we're left in the dark. It would lead us in the opposite direction. So the Rambam gives a number of different examples, and he says, "Umashu kiyotze bezeh b'chol ha-mitzvot, ein machloket bo lefi shehem kulam perushim mikubalim mimoshe, va'alehem va'al domehem amru, kol ha-tore ne'emra kloteo prateo v'diktukeha. Aval, im heotam mikubalim ve'ein machloket behem, מחוכמת המקרא הנתון שאפשר להוציא ממנו אלו הפירושים באפנים מן ההקשים והסמכים והרמזים וההודעות המצויים בכתוב. וכאשר תראים בתלמוד נושאים ונותנים ונחלקים במערכת העיון ומביאים ראיה על דבר מאלו הפירושים ודומיהם, כאמרם במאמר יתלל, פרי עץ הדר, אולי הוא רימון, אולי הוא פריש, או זולתם. So when the Gemara has a discussion about the nature of all of these things, that doesn't mean that there's a machloket about what an etrog is, but is trying to get at something else. So when the Gemara suggests hypothetically. It's in the realm of the hypothetical. When the Gemara says, maybe the Pri Eitz Hadar is a pomegranate, or etc., right? So it's there to teach you what Pri Eitz is and what Hadar is, right? Eitz Shatam Eitzo Piryo Shavin V'amar Achar Pri Hadar Bilano Mishana L'Shana. These are different teachings in Masechet Sukkah about the Etrog. But it's not that there was a machloket about the essential definition. Ela ra'inu b'lo safek miyoshua ad elenu she'etrog haya nital im halulav b'chol shana ve'ein machloket b'ze. ואמנם הם חוקרים אחר האורה המצויה כתוב, זה הפירוש המקובל. Hold on a second, let me just look at the chat. Somebody wrote something in the chat. So Sherry asks, are there textual clues that tell us that a discussion such as this example is hypothetical and not an actual debate? I mean, there aren't textual clues in the Torah. You're asking about the textual clues in the Gemara. Yeah, so in the Gemara, it's clear that there's never a tradition of... In other words, in the Gemara, there's no machloket about the identification. You never have a statement where one of the Tanoim or one of the Amoroim says, Pri Eitz Hadar means pomegranate. Or Pri Eitz Hadar means an apple, or Pri Eitz Hadar means a watermelon, right? And the nature of the discussions about what the message of the pasuk is, in both cases they're all pointing to etrog, but for different reasons. And they're trying to say in what way is an etrog hadar, in what way is an etrog beautiful? It's beautiful because it has something to do with the way that the way the fruit tastes, or the way the taste of the fruit resembles the taste of the tree, whatever that means. Or it's beautiful in the way that the fruit remains on the tree. But everybody agrees that it's an etrog. It's just a debate about what the symbol is, what the word hadar symbolizes. So then it becomes clear. Let's go on just a bit. Vizehu inyan amram klaloteha ufrateha. So when the Rambam says, when the Gemara says that all of the Torah was given klal ufrat, general principles and specific details, klomar shehadvarim asher tireh otanu motziim otam bechlal ufrat v'chein b'shar 13 midot heim mikubalim mimoshe misinai, that klal uprat, general principles and specific details, the 13 principles by which the Torah, the hermeneutical principles, the 13 principles by which the Torah is interpreted, that these themselves are given from Sinai. I hope you've had a chance to look at, and I mentioned to you before, and I put it up on our Shear's homepage, that it's worth looking over that brisa, the Shlosh Esrei Midot Shatorah Nidreshet Bahem, the hermeneutical principles. Hermeneutics is a fancy term that means the modes of interpretation, or the rules or methods of interpretation. The methods of interpreting psukim is part of what was given over to Moshe. That when you see a pasuk, that there's a mode of interpreting it. And those things that are learned out by the Chachamim through the 13 principles, the application of those principles, at least the application through consensus of the Chachamim, generate Torah Misinai. So that there are at least two different ways or two different directions that Chazal interpret Psukim. There's a type of derivative focus, and there's a type of attributive focus. Sometimes Chazal are looking to derive the halakha. They're trying to determine what is the Torah getting at. And other times, they're trying to hook something back to a pasuk. The Rambam goes on to explain, Ulam im heyotam mikubalim im Moshe, lo yamru behem halakha le Moshe misinai. So when we say that the pre Eitz Hadar is not a halacha la Moshe Misinai, that doesn't mean that Moses was unaware of it. And the Rambam here is going to differentiate between types of interpretation which have a hook in the text and types of interpretation which stand free of the text. When there's a textual hint at something, but it is unclear, when the Torah says, ayin tachat ayin, an eye for an eye, or a tooth for a tooth, and we have a tradition that pasuk is interpreted in the following way, against the literal meaning, that is not a halakha la Moshe Misinai. That is a halakha which is learned out from the interpretive process. But when there's a halakha which has no textual hook, that's what's called a halakha la Moshe Misinai. Right, so the Rambam says, one second, here you go. One moment, please. There you go. There, I hope you can see the arrow. We don't call the identification of the pre-Eitz Hadar, we don't call that a halakha la Moshe Misinai. And we don't call the case of Chovel b'chaveiro meshalem mamon, we don't call the halacha that if you poke out my eye, you owe me money. That's also similarly not a halacha l'Moshe Mi-Sinai. Why are those things not classified as halachot l'Moshe Mi-Sinai? Because ho'il ukfar hushrash etzlenu ki haperushim kulam mi-Moshe. Clearly, all of the interpretations go back to Moshe. V'yesh lehem k'moshe amarnu hora'ak bakatuv. But these things are written in the Torah. When it says ayin tachat ayin, what does that mean? It means money. When it says pri etz hadar, what does it mean? It means etrog. What's the problem? We just might not know that without the tradition that that's how it's read. And if we try to read it outside of the tradition, independent of the tradition, we're going to come to the wrong conclusion. If I don't know anything about the English language, I'm going to mispronounce that word. But if I'm a member of the community, if I'm the recipient of the tradition about how to read English, I'm going to pronounce that word kernel, you know, like a kernel of corn, and not kolonol, which is not a word. But I only know that, I only get it right, if I'm a recipient of the interpreted tradition. But what's a halacha l'Moshe Mi-Sinai? A halacha l'Moshe Mi-Sinai is not how to read the Torah. It's not a stop sign that tells you pre Eitz Hadar means etrog, right? As if we could. That's why I compared it to Kri Uchtiv. That's why I compared it to the case of Kri Uchtiv, where there are certain things that are written in the Torah one way but pronounced another. But pre Eitz Hadar is a type of Kri Uchtiv on the plane of ideas, right? It's written pre Eitz Hadar, but when you read it, you know it means in Esrog. It says ayin tachat ayin, but I know that it means something else, right? It's like any type of being inside to the language. I know that when my particularly my oldest son, and this is true probably for all children, we used to say that the sarcasm gene hadn't kicked in yet because he just did not get sarcasm. And around our house, there's, you know, not a small amount of sarcasm. And think about it, just try to pay attention in the workplace or in your family, around the table, wherever you are in life. There's always a certain amount of sarcasm. It's an interpretive tool in language. It's a way we encode meaning to language where it means something else other than the literal black on white, what the sentence might mean outside of the context of how we embed meaning into it. I don't know. Imagine the humor. I mean, it's probably like a Marx Brothers routine. You know, imagine the humor. Just sitting around lunch in the workplace. If you interpret every sarcastic comment, even mildly sarcastic comments, as sincere, as literally sincere, you'd be led to all types of humorous. At best, humorous, and at worst, tragic results. But you have to know that when somebody spills something all over the rug and somebody says, "Oh, great," they're not actually saying, "Hey, that's really fantastic." It means the exact opposite. They're being sarcastic, and that's the meaning of "Oh, great" is, even though a literal meaning would lead you to the opposite conclusion. So the Torah Sheba'al Peh colors it codes the meaning so that you know when oh great means yay and when oh great means the exact opposite. That's what the Torah Shebal Peh is. What's the literal meaning? What's the pshat of oh great when something spills on the rug? The pshat is that's really bad. These are not halachot l'Moshe Misinai. None of these. These are, of course, my examples. But these examples that we gave earlier, etrog, ayin tachet ayin, these are not halachot l'Moshe Misinai. This is the proper way to read the pasuk. Halacha l'Moshe Misinai, on the other hand, is, the Rambam says, kol inyan she'ein lo hora'a bekatuv. The category that we call halacha l'Moshe Misinai are all of the laws given by Hashem to Moshe, which Moshe passed over to us, all of the laws that do not have that textual hook. Right? Ayin tachat ayin has a textual hook. You just have to know how to read the text. Right, but halacha l'Moshe Misinai are things that don't have something in the text and can't be derived from the text, through the hermeneutical principles. What the Rambam here calls hekesh. Hekesh, I told you, is sometimes is a synonym for all of the interpretive rules of drasha. Bezeh bilvad yamar halacha l'Moshe Misinai. And then the Rambam gives you a list of 30 some odd halachot l'Moshe Misinai, depending on how you count. And this is the one place where we've collected up the list of all of the halachot l'Moshe Misinai. I'll just mention some of them. It would take quite a few shiurim to go through all of them. But first of all, just to know, if somebody, this is a question that comes up, how do we know what the halachot l'Moshe Misinai are? So the Rambam has gathered them together here in the introduction to the commentary on the Mishnah. Let's just pick a few of them. Tefillin and mezuzot and Sefer Torah, the laws of how these things are written. In other words, the Torah, interestingly, the Torah doesn't specify precisely what tefillin are. And it doesn't specify precisely how they're made, or what they look like, or what's inside of them. The Torah does talk about totafot vayu leot al yodecha vayu letotafot bein einecha, like we say in the Kriyat Shema. But we're not even sure precisely what the word totafot means. If you read the Ramban on that pasuk, he says a number of different interesting things in this matter. All of these are halachot l'Moshe Misinai. The shin shebetfilin, the kesher shebetfilin, right? These are all things that are halachot l'Moshe Misinai. The way the straps are tied, like we say in the Anam Zmirot, you know, it's become much more popular to sing the Anam Zmirot at the end of Shabbat davening. Kesher tefillin hera le'enav, that the tefillin knot, the way in which the tefillin is bound and tied, that this was shown to Moshe. Ritzuot shchorot, nowhere in the Torah does the Torah say that the tefillin have to be black, specifically that the straps have to be blackened. That's a halacha l'Moshe Misinai. It's not part of the halachot mikubalot because it doesn't have a textual hook to it. It's just something that if you know it, you know it. If you don't know it, there's no way we'd be able to derive it from the text. God says to Moshe, Totafot Beinecha, Moshe's the scribe, Moshe's the secretary. He's taking dictation up there in Har Sinai. And he writes down, Totafot Beinecha. And then he says, hey, time out. Pardon me, God. What are Totafot? And God explains. They're these boxes. They're perfectly square. They have parshiot in them. They have these scroll pieces in them with the following text. They're black. The straps have to be perfectly black, etc. That's all the instruction manual, the oral instruction manual that comes along with it. Sherry asks about kashrut. So the idea, the principle of kashrut is in the Torah. The Torah in a few different places points out that there are things that are forbidden to eat, there are things that are okay to eat. The Torah itself points out the general principle, at least, of meat and milk. But the Torah doesn't spell out precisely what meat and milk is. And we learn out from the fact, as a perfect example, the Torah three times says, Lo tivashel gidi b'chalev imo. Three times this pasuk is repeated, that you shouldn't cook a kid in its mother's milk. And the Chazal learn out from this, that there are three components to the prohibition. That you can't cook meat and milk together, even if you don't eat it. You're not allowed to cook it together. There's an independent prohibition of cooking meat and milk together, even if you're not going to eat it. There's no prohibition, at least not from the Torah, to cook shrimp, which is not kosher. You just can't eat it. But meat and milk, you're not even allowed to create this mixture. There's a separate isser, a separate prohibition to eat meat and milk that have been cooked together. And there's a third prohibition that you're not allowed to derive any benefit from meat and milk that's been cooked together. And this is a halakha mikubelet, learned out from the three-time repetition of that pasuk. So some things in kashrut, the fact that a pig is not kosher, the fact that pork is not kosher, right? So that's not a halakha, that's just a halakha. That's the Torah, that's beferush, right? It's spelled out specifically in the Torah that you can't eat pork. This idea about the nature of meat and milk, that's probably more in the category of the halakha mikubelet, because it's learned out from this repetition, or certainly the idea that you can't benefit from hana. The Torah specifies you can't cook it together, but we learn out about the eating and the benefits from the interpreted tradition. And then there are other things that are halachot l'Moshe Mi-Sinai. Kashrut, of course, is a very multifaceted halacha. So these are some of the examples of the halachot l'Moshe Mi-Sinai. And the Rambam lists them. You can go through them if you're interested. The Rambam then goes on. Oh no! All right, so we'll stop at that. But I just wanted to very quickly look at something else. Here. The Rambam then goes on. I'll just introduce this topic before we get to it next time. Well, what's the difference? A halacha l'Moshe Mi-Sinai, is that min ha-Torah? Is that biblical in nature? What do you think? No. Here, vote. A halacha l'Moshe Mi-Sinai, is it min ha-Torah? Or is it midrabanan? Raise your hand from the participants panel. Raise your hands if you think a halakha l'Moshe Mi-Sinai is midrabanan, is rabbinic in nature. Raise your hand if you think that Halacha LaMoshe MiSinai is... Esther, which one did you vote? Oops, I just muted you. I'm going to unmute you. A halacha LaMoshe MiSinai, is it rabbinic or biblical?
I think it's rabbinic.
Alan, what do you say? Alan?
Biblical.
Yeah, it's biblical. Even though it's not written in the Torah. That's what you just have to be clear on something. When we say these two categories, midirabanan or min haTorah, rabbinic or biblical doesn't mean that it's written in the Bible. It means that it was commanded by God. And even though it's only written either between the lines of the Bible, like the halachot mikubalot are the things that are written between the lines, and the Torah Shebaal Peh teaches you how to read between the lines. And the halachot LaMoshe MiSinai are the things that aren't even written between the lines, but they're commanded by God. So when we say something is min haTorah, from the Torah, or biblical in force, it doesn't mean that it is or is not written in the Torah. It means that it's God-given, as opposed to enacted by the rabbis. So for example, we're coming up on Purim. Purim is a rabbinic holiday. It takes place after the Bible is written. The Chachamim, the sages, innovate it. They do it according to a certain model, but it's completely rabbinic in nature. But the fact that the tefillin have to be black, the straps of the tefillin have to be black, even though nowhere in the Torah does it say that, that is a Torah obligation. Because it's a halacha LaMoshe MiSinai. God said this is the requirement. So it's min haTorah in the sense that God commanded it. The question is, how do we count the mitzvot? We have this notion from here in the end of Masechet Makot, Darash Rabbi Simloi, Sheish Me'ot U'Shlosh Esrei Mitzvot Nemru Lo LaMoshe, Shlosh Me'ot V'Shishim V'Chamesh Lavin Keminyan Yemot HaChama, Matayim Arbaim Shmona Asar K'neged Evarav Shel Adam. There are 613 mitzvot, 365 negative commandments, 248 positive commandments, symbolically representative of different things. Everybody agrees to this. Everybody agrees to this number that there are 613 mitzvot. But there is not a unanimity about how to count. It's interesting that the Gemara itself does not give you a list of what the 613 mitzvot are, but it appears to be this drasha of Rabbi Simloi of how we get to the number 613, which is actually based upon a gematria of the word Torah. I see there's a typo here on the page. It says Ora, it should be Torah. When I cut and pasted it, I must have chopped off a letter. Torah tziva lanu Moshe, Morasha. Torah begematria shesh meot v'chadzarei, shit mea v'chadzarei, 611. The gematria of Torah is 611. 400 plus 6 plus 200 plus 5 is 611. Anochi v'lo yielecha mipi agvura shamanum. Torah tziva lanu Moshe. Moshe taught us Torah. Moshe taught us 611 mitzvot. Two mitzvot, the first two of the Ten Commandments, the Jewish people heard directly from Hashem. 611 plus 2 is 613. So this notion obviously predates Rabbi Simloi. This was a long-standing tradition that there are 613 mitzvot, 248 plus 365. But how you determine what they are is a matter of debate. So already from the times of the Geonim, and then later the Rishonim, there was a tradition of trying to enumerate what the 613 mitzvot are. But even though there's unanimity about most things, I mean, everybody agrees that tefillin is a mitzvah. There's no rishon that thinks that tefillin is not a mitzvah. But there's a machloket about whether tefillin is one mitzvah or two mitzvot. Do you read it is it one composite mitzvah with two parts, one on the hand and one on the head? Or are these two separate, but obviously related, mitzvot? So if you think that tefillin is two separate mitzvot, like, by the way, the Rambam does, the Rambam counts them as two separate mitzvot, so then you have to take something off the list. If you think that tefillin is only one mitzvah with two parts, then you have to find something else to add to the list. The Rambam wrote the Sefer HaMitzvot, which is a kind of preamble to the Mishneh Torah. He wrote it before he wrote the Mishneh Torah. But the Sefer HaMitzvot is his list of the 613 mitzvot. A very, very short, essay on each of the 613 mitzvot. But before he sets out what he thinks that 613 mitzvot are, he lists 14 shorashim, 14 root principles, and he explains how he does his counting. He explains how he derives what gets counted as a mitzvah, and what doesn't get counted as a mitzvah. Among the significant things that emanate from these 14 principles, not to be confused, please don't confuse these with his famous 13 principles of faith, which we learned together last semester. These 14 roots or 14 principles are the rules by which you determine the count of what gets counted as a mitzvah and what does not. That does not constitute the end-all and be-all of rabbinic, or of the end-all and be-all of religious life and obligation. There are certain things that are obligatory, even obligatory min ha-Torah, but for technical reasons don't get counted separately on the list of the 613 mitzvot. But they're there. They're obligatory. Next week, we'll look here at this second Shoresh, where the Rambam discusses the themes that we touched on tonight in terms of how things get counted and what's the difference between something which is explicit in the Torah, something which is learned out from a textual hook, and the Halachot LeMoshe Misinai, the obligatory and authentic interpretations, which are not rooted in the text itself. If you're interested, I encourage you to go to our Shir homepage and look up this source called Shoresh 2, I think it's called, and to study it or look it over before our next session next Thursday night. Shabbat Shalom.